Hello.
Glad to have you come to the radio.
Thank you.
And I'll try to cooperate with your biographical background according to my, as far as my memory will allow me.
Yes, well, if you could start out with the town where you were born, you know, the important local.
Well, I was born in Princeton, New Jersey, June 17, 1916. And at the time, my father was working at Princeton University on a doctorate degree in the history of art. And my sister, older sister, was also born in the same house in Princeton. But after my father got his degree, we moved for an interim period to Langhorne, Pennsylvania, just about a year. And eventually we settled in Swarthmore, which is 12 miles southwest of Philadelphia, as you may know. My father and mother built a very comfortable home there in 1922, I believe. And that's where I grew up until I left art school. So all my formative years were at Swarthmore, and I went to preparatory school for a number of years, Swarthmore Prep, I think from the fourth grade on up through the ninth grade. And then my mother, who was a Quaker, we're both, but my family are Quakers, and my mother wanted me to have a little Quaker education, so she sent me to West Ham School, which is not too far from the Swarthmore. And I went there for 2 years. And I have misgivings about that whole experience. I was a complete scholastic miss. I'm not an academic person. I don't have good memories of those years. I, at the same time, I wasn't really ready to be an artist either. I simply enjoyed my home. Both my parents were great travelers. My mother was a Hollander. And she would go to Holland almost every couple of years, and we would go along with her. My father also, being in the art business, this business took him to Europe from the 20s to buy works of art for Philadelphia collectors. At that time, it was before the Depression, there were quite a number of wealthy Philadelphians whom he knew, and he would go abroad and get old master paintings, Van Dyck, Murillo, Rembrandt, the Dutch masters like Weisdahl and Jan van de Capella and so on and so forth. I just, these coming off the top of my head. But this went on for until the stock market crash in 1929. And my father did very well up until that period, and then once millionaires of Philadelphia lost their money, they ceased to buy art. And my father, fortunately, had some museum experience. He was a curator of paintings at the Pennsylvania Museum of Art, which in those days was called the Memorial Hall, still is called Memorial Hall. But in those days, it was called the Pennsylvania Museum of Art. This was prior to the Parker Museum, which we know of today. And my father was curator of that museum for 7 years, and during that time, he learned the restoration of paintings. And so after the stock market crash in 1929, my father turned to restoration of paintings, and he continued to do that the rest of his life. And he went to London to study under some restorers that he knew about and to give himself some background technical knowledge. And so he continued to operate in Philadelphia. And at the museum. But around 1931, my father had a late desire, and maybe years before, to come to Bucks County to meet the family homestead here in Polycom.
Oh.
And unfortunately, my mother and father separated at that time. This was around 1931. I was only 15 or 16 years of age. And they separated, and my father decided to come to Bucks County, and he bought this family farmstead here in Polycom from a cousin named Frank By. And he bought it from Frank By at in those days, back in 1932, a very nominal figure. I can tell you something about Bucks County in the 1930s. Most of the roads around here were dirt roads, and every little hamlet had a blacksmith shop and a general store, grocery store. The mills were still operating, the old Chris Mills here in Spring Valley, Carversville, New Hope, Hempsteadville, all over, especially up along the Delaware River where the Stovers erected all these mills are still in operation when I was a boy. And so my father came up here around 1932 and built, restored what was just a plain Pennsylvania farmhouse with no conveniences at all. We had no plumbing, no electricity to speak of. And it was an outhouse in the back. And we put up with that situation for two or three years until my father saved enough to put in these conveniences. Before he purchased this Bycroft home, they call it Old Congress, which is the term which the Quakers use for as a friends meeting, because our homestead was for a couple of years a meeting place for the Quakers, and they called it Old Congress. And but I remember coming up here, I was about 11 or 12 years old, and my father came up to New Hope with an assistant, and we rented for 2 months, or we were guests for 2 months at a house here on Phillips Mill Road called the Valley Road Guest House. And it's a private home now, but in those days it was a guest home. And we lived there one summer. It was in 31 or so. And I remember going down to the Phillips Mill area, and at that time, canal barges were still going up and down the canal with mules. They were still hauling coal from Easton on down to Morrisville in those days. And they would come back with some other supplies. Either went down with coal or lumber and came back empty for another load of coal from Easton. But shortly after that period, the canal barges went out of business because the railroads, of course, were even many years before, but the railroads really put an end to the canal business. But that was a very picturesque sight to see in those days. Yeah.
Vicki, how did you happen to get that
Well, my father was an artist of sorts. He wasn't a professional painter in the usual sense, and he didn't paint pictures to sell the way I do. Painting to him was an avocation, sort of a hobby. But he was good at it. He liked to do landscapes and portraits, but he didn't develop a reputation of the substantial to make it worthwhile for me to make a living at it. But it was a good sideline for him. And of course, he, being in the art world, it let me off on the mini. I mean, I saw paintings ever since I was small fry. And my mother's people were collectors of art. And they had, they bought art in Holland, and they liked painting and so on. It was nothing for me to have an appreciation for painting and that kind of thing.
I feel like there's a difference between appreciating him too. McGill was that he has always been fun, and I always appreciated him, but he's really
interested in the my father had a studio here in Holland Town, and one day he set up a still life for me to do. Or I think we both worked on it together. I mean, he had the optics, that's what that way. He had the optics, and I put a few things together, like a little bottle and some drapery and a plate or something like that. And I did a little oil painting of that, and I tried to do it as carefully and realistically as I could, without much really knowledge. Going back to Westtown again, I did take up all the art that they allowed me to take, and I had a little background experience from the art teacher at Westtown School, who was an Englishman. I picked up a little there at Westtown about how to mix oils, you know, how to, I didn't know what it was all about, and anyway, but you worked on canvas and you had brushes and had paint, and I didn't do watercolors at all, that came later. At that time, too, I met N.C. Wyatt, the famous illustrator, because Wyatt lived in Chad's Ford, which was only a few miles from Westtown. And one of the most inspiring field trips we made when I was at Westtown was to visit Henshi White Studio. And that was a great experience for me to meet him. Andy, at the time, was only about my age. Andy, I think, is about 68, and I'm 69. So he was just my contemporary. But so I met Andy back in those days, and he was a tutor of his father. I don't believe Andy ever went to art school. Everything he knew, he learned from his father. Yes. Oh, that's right, yes. Well, he's quite an individual character, you know. He's a complete nonconformist in dress and manner. And his mother was a Mennonite, so he would wear Mennonite tunics and clothing, which was the custom in the Mennonite area of Lancaster County. But that part of Westtown was very beneficial to me, although scholastically I was a complete misfit, so to say.
I know what you're saying, because I was too. And it just seems that sometimes when, if you understand the divisions of the brain, the creative side of the brain takes over, and the reasoning side of the brain sort of takes the rest. Did you know that?
Psychologists, I like to analyze things which we take for granted. don't give it any thought, other than what kind of that's up to a psychologist to analyze and make a opinion about.
But I think it's interesting to when we understand that there are different functions, and sometimes one will have proteins from the other different times, and one is at a different rate of health. But I think, that's probably what happens. We want to
particularly as we're inclined to paint or do art work, but they eventually became creative in other areas. But now going back to the period after 1932, I left Westtown at 34, on the class of 34, and one thing which is very remarkable about that school is once you have gone there, no matter how inadequate you were, they won't let you, they'll never forget you. And they forget any circumstance which you want to forget, they will overlook it. And they have a way of accepting you for the rest of your life, which I think is very admirable. So I am the class of 34, but I left. And my father and mother decided that instead of making me endure any more agony, academic activity, they let me go to art school in Philadelphia. And in those days, it was the Pennsylvania Museum School of Industrial Art. That's what was called, which is now the Philadelphia College of Art. And my father actually had been there too when he was younger. He went to the Pennsylvania Museum School of Industrial Art, and he knew the director, who was a very close friend of his, a man named Edward Warwick, and one of the best known teachers at the time, Henry Pitt, was also a close friend of my father. So my father says, Ronald, you're going to go to art school, and you will study under Henry Pitt and Earl Border and a lot of these people that I know, and so I did. And I immediately took to it. That was one of the happiest 4 years of my life, to go to that art school. And although it was in Philadelphia, and I was living with my mother in Swarthmore still at the time, because it was within commuting distance. I get on the train in Swarthmore and be in Philadelphia in half an hour, and I did that for 4 years. My mother continued to live in Swarthmore, although my father had moved up to Bucks County. So I graduated from the School of Industrial Art in 1938, and then I left Swarthmore. There was no reason for me to stay there any longer. And my mother also decided to move away. She moved up to Scarsdale, New York, where she lived till she died. So I moved up to the farm, which is the term we use for by crop. My whole family called it the farm. And that's where I lived until I was first married. I learned watercolor in art school. I took the whole curriculum, and I specialized in illustration at the time. They call it pictorial expression. They didn't have a painting course coach, just painting. It was more of a commercial art course, including sculpture, lettering, photography, illustration, design. So I took what they made me take, you see, and as well as painting. And after the first, second year, then they let you specialize more. But the first 2 years was pretty much just light drawing, drawing from the cast, which today is almost unheard of.
Drawing from the cast?
Yeah, the plaster cast, you know, these Greek sculpture reproductions of Hercules and these figures of Venus de Milo and the discus thrower, all those things were plaster cast, and we drew from them in charcoal. And there was a technique which demanded a great deal of patience and skill to render these white sculptures in charcoal. And some of my colleagues were really masters of it. I immediately found, when I was in my own element, how inadequate I was, even though I had some background in art. I immediately was put in, I knew right away where I stood with my colleagues. You know, I was struggling, but I liked it, and I had to work hard to keep up. Because when you're in your own school of development, you were in a different class of ability, and I immediately there were some my colleagues who were very gifted and extremely able to do these things, which I had to struggle with, like drawing the light figure and rendering of charcoal and using my imagination. These things didn't come naturally to me, really had to work hard at it. But I liked it, and I did it reasonably well, I think. And I left art school in 38 and went up to the farm, and then I started working for my father.
How did you start
with
watercolor? It seems like the medium was made for you.
Well, they had a watercolor class. School of Industrial Art under Frank Copeland, and I kind of liked it right away. I thought, see, this is a very fascinating medium, and I couldn't get the hang of it at all for the longest time. I don't know if I can ever master this physical medium, but it has such a fascination for me that I just kept with it, and I would do it in all of my spare time. On weekends, I'd go back in the woods around Swarthmore and up in the country to make sketches along the Crum Creek and some of the old mill houses which were along the quarry. And I just went out whenever I could and struggled with this medium. And after a couple of years, I really began to feel better about it. The difficult medium to master, and the fact that the rest of your life you're still trying to master it. Although technically I can handle all the problems that come along, that's not the problem. The problem is making good pictures. The technique of watercolor, I think most people can learn. The bottom line really is to come up with a good painting, which involves composition and design and color and interpretation and so on and so forth.
I've seen so much of your work, so I think that you
would do that. So I really took a lot of, I did all the watercolor which I could and still keep up with the assignments at school, because they gave you a lot of homework to do, and I had to do that as well.
I figured that if you mentioned about the series that you did on the Victorian house, you have a book, which I own, by the way, of Victorian textbook, and you also did writing.
That's right. Well, that came later, Narita. I got married in 1941, and almost immediately I was put in the... well, at first I was put into a civilian public service camp, which was run by Countries Objectives, and that didn't work out too well for me. They shipped me way off to the mountains in North Carolina, and I was very unhappy. The war had started. I eventually wound up in the Army as a medic for 3 years. Air Corps medic. I don't go into all the ramifications of my military experience. I don't think it's too pertinent, but I was in the Army for 3 years. And then we had two children come along. I married a girl by the name of Mary McCarty at Baltimore in 41, and we had a boy and a girl pretty soon after that. After the war was over, I came back to the farm and worked with my father for several years in the restoration business. And I didn't try to make a living just painting. I wasn't ready for that. I got a job down in Philadelphia at the Ward College of Art, which in those days was located at Broad and Master Street up in North Philadelphia. The Ward College of Art was formerly the Philadelphia School of Design for Women, which was founded in 1844 by a woman named Sarah Peter. And that continued under that program until by 1925, when Joseph Moore came along and gave part of his fortune to the art school, and then they named it the Moore College of Art.
Yes,
I heard. So I taught at Moore College of Art for 30 years, and in different capacities as a draftsman, as a watercolor painter, and so forth. And we had a little house built here on the farm. My father restored one of the little outbuildings, and we lived there for a number of years. And I began painting from Bucks County, and by this time it was in the late 40s and early 50s. And you speak about the books I wrote. Well, the books really came out, the stage book came out in 1973, but I had just been painting railroad stations was something which just to me was something to paint. I didn't really get terribly serious about it. I just thought a railroad station was pointless picture material, just like a house with a railroad track in front of it. People on the platform, I thought theaters has more romance to it, more intriguing to me than just painting a house in a street, which I wanted to also, as well as barns and outbuildings and so forth. But I began to do railroad stations, and people seemed to like them a lot, and I sold a lot of them. And before I knew it, I began to have them reproduced. The Philadelphia, I think it was the Philadelphia Inquirer, had a rotor reviewer section in color every Sunday. And one time they took some of my stations and made a feature article out of them. And of course that got quite a bit of publicity, and after that the Reading Company got me to paint a series of four paintings for them of Reading stations, and they had them reproduced, and they got circulated all over Philadelphia. So by that time people began to identify me with doing railroad stations, And I was selling them, I didn't have any for, I wasn't really collecting them, I was just having one-man shows and selling them. And one day, one of my colleagues from school came up to me and said, "Buy," said, "you shouldn't sell on your radio station," says, "you really ought to hold on to a few that you have and make a collection and have them put into a book." And I thought that was a really an interesting thought. And I said, "Well, yeah, I you're right, I'd like to do that." So I went back and did some of these stations all over again that I've done over the last 3 or 4 years, and I kept them. I didn't sell them until I could get them photographed or reproduced, you see. And so eventually I had about 150 watercolors of stations all up and down, not only around Philadelphia, but I took special trips going up and down the East Coast, up into New York State, Connecticut, New Jersey, Maryland, some in New England, not too much, but most of it were New York State, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and a few in Maryland. And then I, by chance, had some of them reproduced in American Heritage magazine. And later, I found a publisher outside of Philadelphia who put them into a book. And that was called The Vanishing Depot, published in 1973. And that book was a really rather nice book. It was, had some 95 illustrations in it, and 60 of them were in color, and the others were in black and white. And unfortunately, this publisher went out of business, or they went bankrupt. I think the editor overextended his line of production. He wanted to put out very fancy, expensive books which didn't pay off. And he spent all his capital, and it wasn't enough coming in to pay for these beautiful books that he was publishing, including my book.
Well, then, if you had that publishing book, I thought that was reprinted.
Well, it was reprinted. I had it reprinted in 84 by another publisher.
Oh.
Yeah, I had it done.
Because there were some copies at the local bookstore. And evidently I got the one that wasn't as rare because I didn't want to buy
the story. And
when I went back, the other ones were gone.
The original edition is out of print, but now you can get the reprint, which was published in 84 by Hepburn House. And they also did my Victorian sketchbook, which I did in collaboration with my sister, Margaret Ritchie, 1980. And so I have both these books out now on the market. So that was just, it really turned out to be kind of a hobby, which I made it to more of a specialty. And I don't say that I've been financially successful, because in both of these books, I put up considerable amount of my own funds to get them printed.
Yeah,
and I didn't do it to make money. I did it just really for the love of preservation. I'm very sympathetic with the preservation movement in our country. I'm a member of the National Trust, and I subscribe to their publications and buy their books, and try to keep up with all their activities. And to me, that's a very important part of our American heritage, is to keep extant what's left of the 19th century in architecture. So much of it is to destroy.
I have I'm studying business.
Did you?
Yeah, of course, and, architecture, I'm a bit, but I'm interested, and, I study in part, in 1980, in the world.
I started to make quite a study of, architecture, and, as a matter of fact, she was about ready to have a book published, by the University of Pennsylvania on the history of evil.
Oh, yes, I'm involved with that. In fact, that's what some of this, research is for, it's for her book.
This project of hers is, going on for years and years. My sister Margaret is a very thorough, very scholarly person, and she, has a way of, maybe, indulging herself in these projects that seem to come to an end. But hopefully, and of course, she's had interruptions in her life. She's had some accidents and she's had some misfortune, which has made inroads on her book. But hopefully, I think the book will, her thesis will come out. It's a history of evil. And she has made a record of every house in New Hope prior to 1875 or that. By various people, including my nephew and my sister.
And that's down by Bycroft Lane that comes out of the curve on Holocaust. Right behind Paxson.
Yes, my, first settler, Thomas By, came over in 1699, and William County gave him a grant of 1,000 acres, which was a large part of Buckingham Township in those days. So he built the first unit of all Congress, which was in those days was just a one-story, one-room structure made out of stone and timber, and that is still there today, although it's been added onto over three different other periods. Thomas Barr, yes. Well, the original building.
The reason I ask is, there are also
And my grandmother, on my father's side, was a tailor. And she, that's right, she grew up in Taylorsville, which is lush, of course.
Also, John Paul, there is a sample in a bedroom that was done by Charlotte Bob and it's dated 1802. And I didn't know that there was a guard down in Washington, but
there were some other guys. I don't know them personally. The guys are not, it's not a common name.
No.
And my father wrote a book on the history of the White family, and many of the guys are scattered around in other parts of the country. And there are some of them that went to the Middle West, and some that went down south. And I don't know of any really close but far relatives right here now.
Well, when you were studying, and when you were younger, and you were painting in the area, were there other teachers that you knew that were painting in this area also, in the Nickelodeon?
Oh yes, I knew. I wasn't very well acquainted with them. They were so much older than I, but I knew Daniel Gardner. I knew Harry Lee Ross much better, and I continued to be a very good friend of his up until the time he retired, and of course he passed away after a long illness, but I knew him while he was active for, 20, 25 years. I also knew Don Balansky very well. Who lived in the North Main Street room. I used to stop there and both these artists. But as a matter of congeniality and camaraderie, to talk to them. And I knew Harry Rosen and Charles Childs. And I didn't know Richfield so well. I only met him once, and by that time he was an old man. Some of these artists, you know, were really retiring people. They're not terribly outgoing, some of them. And so I didn't get to know Redfield. I didn't get to know Carver very well. But I knew Jack Crosby very quite well, and Harry Lee Ross. And George Sauter lived very close to us, a comic on the other stained glass studio, right? On the other side of 202. And I, one summer I went over there almost every day and worked in the studio, and I found him a great, great guy. And also the men that worked with him. He had a very flourishing stained glass business, George Sauter. And I got to know the people that worked under him, the glass cutters, the glazers, the fitters and the cartoonists, and one of them is still living. Charlie Schmoff is still living. He's in his middle 80s. He lives down here in Mechanicsville Road, has a little shop, and he used to work for Sauter for many, many years. But all the other people that worked for Sauter, I think, are passed on. Sauter was a good painter. He was particularly well known for his moonlight scenes of Bucks County,
yes.
Night scenes.
That's why we can.
Sauter was a Catholic.
Oh, right.
Arithmetic in Pittsburgh.
There was a Catholic that was the night that her husband died, and she had an assistant after the dinner, just over there, and just hanging off the wall. And I gathered around in the area and reported by certain individuals.
The only place I can think of right now where you can see somebody sitting in front of you for a while.
Yeah, that is just perfect. This is cool. Okay.
If you ever are fortunate enough to win a gold medal, that's 5 points right off the bat. but if you just want to put there and try, that's one point. So I had to win five different awards to get 5 points. So that made me eligible to give golf.
Southwest. Chuck.
Yeah.
And if you can come right there, you want to, or do you just want to look around?
We don't know anybody, really. I might run into somebody by accident, but I don't have friends there.
But I think it's valid. Chad and I, we're going to be going to travel. We're going to trade houses to connect with one, and we're going to be one of the two parties in my house. But it wasn't for, summer, I'm here. So we're just beginning to, enjoy the luxury of travel. But, I know she's also going to vote paint, for the construction. And, in fact, they're separating, the art gallery, those things. Oh, but that's not Duncan, that's not.
That's it.
They're both beautiful areas, but, do you want to do the thing where,
Well, not just the Nova Scotia, but, after a long period of neglect, been there only twice before over the years, but that, this was in 84, when I went there. Then there they go at 90, up around Fort Clyde, and it's harbor area where quite a few other artists go, which we know very well, but, I decided to look for the Nova Scotia one summer, so we did. And it's a nice big, open country, really. It's, a little more winter than that, a little more desolate. But the coastline is, fascinating. Not quite so much now. Along the coast, it's fairly well settled. The whole coastline of the Atlantic Ocean is pretty well settled from Florida clear up to Newfoundland. I'm telling you that there isn't going to be much real estate left on the Atlantic Ocean the way it's going now. But inland is still pretty inland, you see. Back in the woods, if you want to live in the woods. See the beautiful color
excavated, it won't be Hilo Village, it will be Solbury Township, because New Hope itself is already saturated with Hilo Village. And every time you read the paper, the developers are grabbing land, and the homesteaders are trying to hold on. There's an issue right now down along River Road, where the people are fighting to preserve an area which a developer wants, right there by the 202 bridge, you know. And I hope they win.
Thank you.
George.
Yes, we can have a meeting. And the father of the party.